You are now listening to the Big Beyond Belief podcast with your host, Leo Costa Jr.
Okay, we have a big show today. This is Leo Costa Jr. coming at you from Big Beyond Belief. And I have a really interesting person today. Her name is Kat Long, and she is a five-time world kickboxing champion. To say that she's impressive is a gross understatement, but I tell you what, Kat, welcome to the show. Thanks for coming on. How are you?
I'm doing really well. Thank you. Thank you so much for asking. How are you doing?
Well, you know, for somebody my age, I guess I'm doing okay. It changes like by the minute, you know, it's hard to get old. I was told that.
Yeah, they say getting old is not for sissies.
Well, it isn't. It's not even close to that, you know. And I understand now what my dad meant. It's really funny how this, the people that at one time that you thought were crazy, you know, they knew exactly what the hell they were talking about. And, you know, this is a big circle, and here I am, you know, living it. But I tell you what, the good news is I feel pretty darn good, and I can still get after it a little bit, and, you know, I'll just leave it at that.
Good.
Hey,
I'm glad to hear that.
So let's get started with our show here. I wanted to ask you, first of all, I guess the main thing is, why did you choose martial arts to begin with?
I was a freshman in high school when a friend of mine named Lillian, she invited me to an Aikido class on March Air Force Base. She took me on the base because, you know, she her parents were in the military. She took me on the base and brought me into the class, and the instructor was this big, huge black guy, just an incredibly kind and caring and gentle. It's like a gentle giant, and the environment that he had at his school was very nurturing and very caring, and it was that wasn't something I was certainly growing up with, so I clung to that, and I used to sneak on to March Air Force Base every day and sneak off.
Yeah.
So I was so dedicated to being there. I didn't care what it took to get there to go to class because I just loved that environment so much.
So let me ask you, how you probably just said that you were you in high school? How old were you when you actually went there?
I was 14.
14 years old. And it sounds like you got an environment that was unlike the one that you're in or used to. And that kind
that's
of,
correct.
And that kind of drew you
absolutely
to that.
Absolutely correct.
Yeah. And then, so, and we know how young you were and why you chose it, but when you first started, was there a, like so many times a week, you know, just to inform our audience, when you first started, was it more sort of kind of playtime that wasn't real serious or, you know, right from the get-go, are they starting to teach you about life lessons?
Literally right from the get-go, he taught like life lessons, and I was the gym rat. I was there before they opened, and I stayed after and made sure I cleaned up and closed. You know, I just loved being there so much. And like I said, he was very much like a father figure who was just incredibly kind and nurturing and caring. And it didn't matter what questions you had about life, you know, he'd be happy to sit and talk to you about it. He worked as a postman during the day, and he was, if I recall, he was married, his kids had already grown and left the house, and was just, you know, biding, you know, filling his time teaching Aikido. It was one of those places where, you know, there was no way I was going to miss class, period.
Yeah. So how many times a week would you go?
Oh, you know, I would go, I remember classes being 3 days a week, but there were other activities going on the other 2 days. So I would sneak on and, you know, hit the speed bag and lift some weights and just, you know, just be there because it was a nice, like I said, it was a nice atmosphere, nice place to be, nice environment.
Well, yeah, that's cool. Was he himself, I assume he was an instructor. So did he himself compete or was he around, had been around the business for a long time?
I don't know. I think that his passion was Aikido, but, you know, he didn't talk about himself much. So I really don't know what he did.
Yeah.
He focused more on the students and less on himself, which was, you know, a great role model to look up to.
Yeah, exactly. So after how long did you go before you, did he suggest that you compete, or was that something that that you asked?
No, not at all. I met a young man who was a little older than me when I was 17, and after I got my black belt in Aikido, I started training with this young man that I liked. He was teaching Kung Fu Sansu, but while I was studying Aikido, I was also studying Shoin Ryu Karate, which I don't remember at all. I don't remember anything about it. But, you know, he was very open to the idea of training at other schools, and he encouraged the students there in the Aikido class to train at other places. But when I got into Kung Fu Sansu, which is strictly stick your fingers in, knuckle deep in their eye, hit their windpipe, crush their testicles, stomp on their knee, things that work in an altercation as opposed to focused contact that point karate does. It was during that time that I eventually started competing in kickboxing.
So he was the one that kind of got you started in that then?
No, I got started completely on a dare. No, he had no influence in that whatsoever. I used to go to karate tournaments to compete in forms with weapons and stuff like that, and you know, just for something different to do. And there was this one girl there who kept asking me to compete against her in point fighting. And I said, look, I don't do point fighting. You know, it's just not my style. I don't like it. And one day this girl's instructor called my instructor, who was also my boyfriend, and asked if I'd be willing to do an exhibition kickboxing bout with his girl, who happened to be the girl who challenged me. So I got a sense of what the rules were. I put on gloves and I can punch her and kick her as hard as I wanted to. And I thought, well, okay, that seems pretty fair. And now I only had 10 days to learn how.
Wow.
Because when they asked me if I'd do the exhibition, the event was in 10 days.
Yeah. You said, I think you said point fighting. Is that what you said?
Yes, point fighting is focused contact where you're not allowed to make serious contact.
Oh, okay.
You're not allowed to hit, but you can focus contact.
Gotcha. And
that's not something I am familiar with at all. I'm used to doing the exact opposite, was hit as hard as I possibly can.
That must have been kind of interesting to hold back when you actually got into that. I mean, I would think that would in itself take a certain discipline, because when you're used to, you're reacting in that all-out fighting, if I'm hearing you right, and then to all of a sudden, you know, have to focus fighting?
Well, that's just it, Leo. I never did point fighting. I did not like it. I didn't like the idea of it at the time. That was my mindset.
Yeah.
And I chose to never do point fighting. Well, it's not true. I had one point fighting competition or match, I guess is more accurate. And when I kicked the girl as hard as I could, because they said you can hit to the body as hard as you can. You can hit to the body, punch and kick. So I did a crossover sidekick and I kicked her in the stomach and knocked her down and knocked the wind out of her and got disqualified. And I thought to myself, okay, I don't like point fighting.
Yeah, I guess so.
So when I was challenged to fight with this girl who had done kickboxing for 2 years and also point fighting for many years, I accepted the challenge because I was allowed to hit as hard as I wanted to.
Yeah, so that was more in your wheelhouse.
Yeah, and I thought, well, if I can punch and kick as hard as I want, yes, I'll take that challenge.
Yeah.
And here's the interesting thing. She weighed 190 and I weighed 120.
Oh, man.
Yeah, it's quite a quite a weight difference.
No kidding.
But even though I was scared to death, my adrenaline was charging through me, and I was more excited than I'd ever been in my entire life at that point, and more scared. I just fell in love with the whole adrenaline rush of being scared like that and having to perform.
You know, it's I understand what you're saying. As an athlete, I felt the same way. But it's amazing what one can do or not do when they're scared to death. You know, I think sometimes you either freeze or you respond to that. And obviously, you responded to that. As an athlete, I hated those nerves sometimes. It's kind of a love-hate before a game or a match. But,
yep.
Man, the minute that the whistle blew, it was like something just clicked, you know, or that first punch or whatever, you know, and it was like,
yes.
Oh, yeah, this is where I want to be right here. So when you started, were there as many girls as boys in the, I don't know, a sport, or how did that work out back then?
There were so few women to compete against. You know, all my sparring partners were men. You know, I got beaten up pretty soundly. I'm so grateful for it because that's what helped me rise to the top and win world titles. It was because of my sparring partners, because of their skill level, because of the fact that they pushed me and would hit me and keep me honest. And, you know, there's nothing like that.
And, you know, you have to be willing to make that commitment because it's easier in some cases for people, maybe even the general public. I don't know as far as how it works out in the martial or the arts, but, you know, to push yourself to that degree and to know that you're going to get the hell beat out of you possibly, you know, you are forced and are put in a situation where you either adapt or die, in my opinion. And
it's absolutely true. And, you know, it wasn't possibly get the crap beat out of me. It was constantly.
Just playing constantly.
Yes, just playing constantly.
Yeah, but boy, I'll tell you what, when you're able to, you know, when you realize that, hey, I can take this, and then you start giving it back, that, I mean, for me, I would think that'd be a huge confidence builder. I mean, it would be for me.
It is. It was gigantic. I remember very clearly the very first time in the early time, you know, in my beginning career, the very first time I actually chose to throw a jab cross hook. And when all three of them, of those punches landed on that guy's head, I did the stupidest thing in the world. I stopped and looked at what I did and thought, oh my God, it worked. And of course he's hitting me back.
Yeah.
But I was just so elated that I could actually land three solid punches on this guy's face.
Yeah. It's like,
it was a good feeling.
Well, I could, yeah. It's like, I can do this. Let's go some more, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
No, I got that. That's really funny. So over the years, like, you know, when I first started, for example, in this personal training business back in the 80s, interestingly, especially now, there were hardly any women that were going to gyms back then. I mean, there were, but just compared to now. And one of the big reasons was, you know, they were afraid that they were all going to turn into Arnold Schwarzenegger the minute they stepped inside the gym, which obviously isn't true. But, you know, it's changed over the years dramatically. So how has your sport changed over the years, or has it not? And why, do you think?
Well, if you're talking about just kickboxing, as a sport, you know, the rules, depending on the organization you fight for, has definitely changed. I remember back in 1983, or 87, let's just put it 87, when I was just starting in kickboxing. I remember in the United States, the main set of rules were 8 kicks above the waist and no leg kicks allowed, no knees, no clinching, no elbows, nothing like that. And since then, it has definitely evolved to more international rules where you can knee without clinches, or you can kick to the inside and outside of the legs. Or if you want to go full Muay Thai, because you look at full Muay Thai is so much more dangerous in that respect. So careers, if you look at the fighters in Thailand, they usually start when they're 5, 6 years old. And by the time they're 18, they've retired and their bodies have taken a lot of damage. That's still, of course, very popular, you know, throughout the United States and throughout the world, for that matter. But the more international rules where there's knees without clinches and no elbows, but kicks are allowed pretty much everywhere, that's definitely evolved and grown. And there's organizations now that have, you know, worldwide attention and media coverage. There's regular channels now that cover this particular organization called Glory. And they're just incredibly popular. And there's the fighters, the skill level of the fighters has grown so much so that a fighter of the 80s trying to walk in and compete in a Glory kickboxing match would just be eaten alive.
No kidding.
Yeah.
Interesting. Yeah, you said something that I'm going to ask a stupid question here probably. You said that when you first started, you can only do 8 kicks above the belt. Is that right? Or above the waist?
Depending on the organization, I mean, there were several. So some were allowing what they called back then international rules, which simply meant you're allowed to kick to the legs. Uh-huh. But most of them wanted you to kick 8 kicks above the waist. And the reason that all started in PKA, Point Karate Association, I think is what it's called. The reason that started is because karate, guys who were competing in karate and they wanted to step it up a level and they wanted to, you know, hit harder and hit more often. Because in point karate, the moment you think, the moment there's a point made, you have to stop and restart. But in, they called it continuous sparring or continuous contact. Then boxers were coming in and just beating the crap out of the karate guys because they knew more how to kick and less how to punch, the karate guys. Yeah. So that's where they changed it so that you had to kick 8 times above the waist.
So
just a bit of trivia there.
Well, but here's my question. Who in the hell was counting? Were you like every time you kicked, you counted?
Yes, it was counted. But, I mean, you didn't have to stop, but it was counted by the, they had the specific kick counters.
I didn't know that. So if you kind of if you kick more than 8 times, would they like dock a point or something like that? Slap you?
No,
in the hand?
No. But you can if you kick less than 8 times, you will get docked.
Oh, okay. So you had to at least do 8.
Yeah, a minimum of 8 kicks round is required by each fighter. Okay. And you know, I only fought a couple of times under those rules, but it's a definite adaptation that you have to make. Whether you're allowed to kick to the leg or you're not, whether you're allowed to knee or you're not, whether you're allowed, you know, you have to kick above the waist or you don't. It didn't matter to me what set of rules were placed in front of me. If it was just for me, it was a matter of, okay, I need this fight because I need the experience. I need to grow as a fighter. So I'll accept any rules you can give me.
There you go.
And fight. And it didn't matter.
That's called perfect willingness. One of the questions I have is, in terms of kicking, is there when you kick to the inside or to the outside part of your leg, is there one that's more dangerous than the other as far as kicking on the inside versus the outside, or just a different point?
You have nerve endings on both the inside and outside, and especially the inside, the vastus internus. That can definitely cause more damage, and it's much more painful. The nerves are more sensitive, especially on the, you know, we're kind of designed more like turtles in that respect, where, you know, the nerves are more sensitive on the insides of our arms and the insides of our legs as opposed to the outside.
Interesting. I didn't know that.
Yeah. Much more sensitive. Wow. As far as damage, you know, damage to the leg, you know, either one is just as painful. You can bruise the muscle after a while, and there's not nearly as much muscle on the inside of the thigh as there is on the outside. So if you really want to cause more damage to a fighter, you know, hitting to the inside of the leg, or if you hit the IT band that's just above the kneecap, you know, because that long tendon that starts at your ankle and goes up to your hip bone, if you hit the IT band just above the knee, then you can weaken that tendon, and that makes it hard for the fighter to keep weight on that leg. If you attack that IT band on the outside of the leg, and you weaken that tendon and they can't put weight on it, then you can cause all kinds of damage.
So let me ask you this. When you go into a match, besides being maybe having an approach, a tactic maybe that you want to use as far as something basic, is your mindset to go in and do as much damage as possible?
No, in fact, it's quite the opposite.
Oh, well, see, there you go. I bet you somebody else is thinking like me, or I'm a sick puppy, but I would have thought, you just want to go in and the ultimate goal is to take them out and win, baby, win. But why don't you explain what you're saying?
I just wanted to be the better fighter that day. I didn't want to hurt anybody. I didn't want to cause damage. I know that that's part of the sport. I know that you will cause damage. I know that. But it's also something that we're both perfectly willing partners in that respect.
Mm-hmm.
So not that I deliberately try to damage, but I also know that if I don't, then they will.
Yeah. But so at the same time, it sounds like as a part of the sport, you know, and maybe an unwritten rule or maybe a written rule is that you both respect each other that way. And yet you're going into a brawl, you know, a fight.
Yes. It's absolutely an unspoken rule. that, you know, there is that mutual respect, you know, and basically what you're agreeing to is to abide by the rules.
Yeah.
And that's what you're really agreeing to, because if you knock somebody out, then you knock somebody out. It's not that, I mean, some people intend to do that. Some people want to, some people even look for it and try for that knockout. And sometimes it works. And sometimes, you know, they fail miserably because they were just looking for the knockout.
Right.
And they're focusing on, you know, punching in combinations and making sure that they're disrupting their balance and things right. like that. But, you know, in that respect, if you get knocked out, that's a risk you take.
Yeah.
And that is something that can always happen no matter how good you are.
Right. So what happens if somebody goes rogue? You know, it gives you a cheap shot. Do you like stay controlled and say, okay, you know, they just don't know any better and I'll get to the, you know, to the end? Or do you just like say, okay, you went rogue, so here's a little lesson for you to learn. Bam, bam.
It depends. Once you get skilled enough, you can, as Mozart said once, it's very important to understand the rules so you know how to break them properly.
Good point. I like that. Beautiful. So now, are there any negative connotations for girls or females now being in the sport? Or is it, I don't know, is it pretty evenly accepted? I mean, I don't know, you know.
I would say now in the year 2019, soon to be 2020, that the sport is not only widely accepted, but women are finally getting the purses that they deserve.
Nice.
They're getting paid I won't say nearly as much as men anymore, but I will say, yes, some men still get paid more, but the skill level has grown so much so with women that, you know, it's no longer a novelty. It's no longer, you know, we look at highly skilled women who are phenomenal fighters and they're just as accepted as men are at this point.
Nice.
There may be some old fashioned thought processes out there, but they're dying off,
yeah.
Which is good.
Yeah. So when in these competitions, and maybe it was different back then when you started, because I know you said you fought and practiced against the men, but do girls compete against each other in these sports, or do they compete across, girls compete against boys and vice versa? How does that work?
No, boys do not compete against girls, or girls compete against boys. That's something that I don't think will ever happen, just because... I mean, it's like getting a female tennis player who's the top in her game and getting a female and a male tennis player again who's the top in his game, and you're going to have them compete against each other. Well, the men are stronger. They have a thicker bone density.
Yeah.
They may or may not be faster, but, you know, it's, you know, when you get people in high-level sports, you know, they're pretty darn close to competing against each other. They could, but I think in that respect, for the most part, it depends on the individual.
Yeah.
Let's put it that way.
And listen, there's women that could, you know, tear men apart. I mean, there's no question about that, but just as a general rule of thumb, what you're saying, I think is accurate in my opinion as well. When you, I know when you started, practicing, but just to give our audience just an idea, when you first, start practicing, how does that change when you decide that you want to start competing? You know, is it like, is it 3 days a week before you make that week, before you cross over that magic line?
Oh, it's 6 days a week. And for some people it's 7 days a week, but you know, there, when I was competing, it was 6 days a week. And without a doubt, 2 to 3 workouts a day.
So
every day.
Let me ask you that. When you're doing 2 to 3 workouts a day, like how long did your sessions last? Per session?
Well, they lasted a minimum of 1.5 to 3 hours, sometimes 4 hours.
Each one?
Oh, each one.
Holy smoke.
Yeah. When I was doing what we call twofers, that's twice a day.
Right.
The morning, here's an example of what my morning training was. I would get up and run 5 miles which I had to do in a certain amount of time, 34 minutes. So I'd run 5 miles, then I'd come straight to the gym and hit the heavy bag for a minimum of 10 rounds. Then, you know, I would either jump rope or I would shadow box or I would do something that just, you know, kept my body moving in what was needed. And that would be the morning workout. And then the evening workout would be sparring for 12 rounds, hitting the bag for 10 rounds, jumping rope for 45 minutes, doing all kinds of calisthenics, you name it, I did it. Mm-hmm. And that would be the evening workout. And then, you know, maybe get something to eat and crawl into bed and pass out.
Okay. Well, that makes sense. I mean, so here's my question, and this is more asking or, you know, talking about how it works with lifting weights. The Bulgarians were known to train 5 times a day, but in their sessions, they kept their sessions 25 to 30, 35 minutes long because going that length of time, their body was able to recover. They figured out it would take, you know, no more than 5 hours for the body part to recover. And so they kept their sessions shorter and more frequent. And they said with that approach, they never overtrained. It sounds to me like as long as you were, you know, as long as you were that length of time of training, how in the hell could your body recover? I mean, I guess your body does eventually adapt, but if you're doing too much, you know, you can overtrain that. Did any of that happen to you where you noticed that maybe you had to cut your sessions down, or it was just, you know, the body had just had to adapt, period?
My body just had to adapt because I had no choice. You know, once I chose that I was going to become a fighter, then, and you know, my trainer was a Marine, so he understood what it was like to just torture people in training. And I use that term loosely, but it was also true.
Yeah.
It was also true. I mean, I literally got to the point where I was doing more than the guys in the gym because I was just determined to make sure that I was the best fighter there.
And, you know,
I was determined.
With that being said, it's just amazing how a strong mindset and motivation, how far that can take a human, you know? And I think that's
yes.
a really good example of that. And that's, you know, so many times that's just missing, you know, even like with the people that I'm training at the gym, it's just like they lack motivation a lot of times. And when you find somebody like yourself, it's like it's proof that you can do way more than you think you can. You just got to get out there, but you have to have something that drives you, that you're willing to, as Tom Platz used to say with training, to walk in fire every single day, because that's what you were doing. Constantly
yes.
taking yourself there, and that sure as hell is not, that's even worse than getting, you know, older, you know, talk about it's not for the faint-hearted. I mean, to do that, what you were doing is incredible, and you don't even know how incredible that is until you walk in your shoes. I'm sure of that. So when you, you know, question I would have that maybe our audience would want to know is, do you have to be strong to be a martial artist?
Are you talking about physically strong, emotionally strong, mentally strong?
In this case, physically strong.
You do not have to be physically strong. However, it will help you build strength while you're training in martial arts.
So what you're saying then that your body, as you're going through the moves that you're doing, will automatically build a certain amount of strength. Is that what you're saying?
There is no question that it will build strength.
Okay. So if you have somebody that is stronger than you, then how is it that you're going to beat them? If they have this functional strength, you know, if everything is equal, you know, what is going to make you, besides, I'm just talking about a certain kick maybe, okay? If you're both doing this certain kick, but your opponent is stronger, how do you, you know, kick for kick, how do you, what's the defense for that? Or what's the solution for that?
Well, if you're talking about in the terms of sparring, where somebody's going to kick at me and they're much stronger than me, my goal was always to have better timing.
Okay.
Which meant the moment they started to move, I attacked first, and or I would be able to evade it and strike them without getting hit. And that's something that came with tons and tons and tons and tons and tons of practice and learning to keep them at a one-step distance where they have to take a step to reach me. And once they tried to kick me, as soon as they took that step and I saw that right side of their body coming forward and I knew it was a kick, I responded accordingly, because you need to learn tons of defenses for it, not just block and hit back. That's basic. But to counter it, meaning make a miss and make them pay for it. Make a miss and you hit them at the same time.
Yeah.
So combating that, you know, I mean, if it were just, okay, let's hit the bag, let's see who can kick the bag the hardest and move the bag the furthest. Well, of course, because they're much bigger and stronger, they can do that. But if it came to kicking me as hard as they could, or I kick them as hard as they could in a sparring match, the goal was always to make them miss and make them suffer. Yeah. It's all about timing. You don't have to be stronger. You don't have to. You just have to have better timing.
Right. Because, you know,
you don't have to be faster.
Well, because here's the, I was kind of leading down this path because, and again, this may just be different. Like in the sport of football, for example, you know, when you have a big, like these linemen today are huge. Okay.
Yes.
So if you have a big, strong lineman on offense and you have a defensive guy, okay, the guy that's going to win, assuming that they're both good on their feet, you know, kind of apple to apple that way, the more explosive athlete will usually win that fight at the line, you know, because obviously the offensive guy is trying to keep the defensive guy away from the quarterback. But
right.
If you have one person that's smaller, because a lot of times what happens is the defensive person is actually smaller than the offensive
right.
person, but they're not as strong, but they're more explosive. In other words, they're quicker.
Yes.
And so I guess that's where I was going. You know, how do you develop that explosive power? Besides, maybe you give the answer in that it took a boatload of practice to learn how to do that. But, you know, like in my world, when I'm training somebody for a sport, because it's so specific, depending on what side, in this case, what side of the ball they play on, it changes the way I train them, you know, to be explosive versus maybe being a little stronger. But they're usually...
Well,
the person that's more explosive wins that battle.
You're right. You're absolutely right on that one. And I think I did a crap load of sprinting and explosive jumping and starting off the gate as fast as I could, you know, as if I were going to sprint, you know, the mind-body connection, they have to work together in that respect, because if you think about it and then you do it, it's too late.
Right.
And that fraction of a second is what makes all the difference.
Sure.
And
especially, you know, at that level.
Right. And it's you know, I equate it to a cobra that is sitting quietly, patiently, alert, but poised and relaxed at the same time.
Yeah.
And when it strikes, it doesn't hesitate. It doesn't think about striking first. It just strikes.
Yeah. It's a reaction.
It's a response.
A response. Yeah. Interesting. So how important, you know, is mindset? Before you answer that, one of the things, like in my, you know, is what's always asked in our sport is what's most important. Is it training? Is it diet? You know, in your sport, is how important is mindset? And how do you develop a mindset?
I guess if you practiced what it's one of those situations where, you know, how do you teach mindset? Well, it's repetition over and over and over. But if that person isn't doing the mind, you know, what, let's say you say to yourself, all right, you know, no matter what, I'm going to by the end of August, I want to be able to do, or the end of September, I want to be able to do 1,000 push-ups in one day. So how do you get to that point? How do you get to where you can do 1,000 push-ups a day? You know, one push-up at a time, right?
Yeah, it's kind of like eating an elephant. How do you eat an elephant? One bite at a time.
Exactly.
Same idea.
One push up at a time. Yeah. But you have to keep going because there will be setbacks. There will be times when you're discouraged. There will be times when you're tired. There will be times when you just don't feel like doing anymore. There will be times when your arms are wobbling and you don't think you can do another one. And you just do another one.
Yeah.
No matter what, you do it. You do it anyway.
Yeah.
And some people have that drive and some people don't. And, you know, I'm not saying that it cannot be developed. But it takes in that respect, I would think it would take a team of people to help you adopt that mindset.
Yeah.
Because, you know, maybe it's something that you're not used to, but if you're willing, if you're open and it's okay to be pushed beyond your comfort zone and be supported at the same time, then of course you can develop that mindset.
Yeah. And what you're saying basically is one of the things I learned in the 80s. That my trip to Bulgaria was so amazing. Those guys are they were 8 years ahead of all the stuff that was going on out here. And one of the first things I learned from them, those coaches, was repetition is the mother of skill. And they said, you teach the body and the mind what you want it to do. You know, and
right.
it sounds very easy coming out of their mouth, but once you get into the arena, so to speak, to make that happen. And this is what cracks me up. I don't know about martial arts, but so many people in the sport of bodybuilding, they like the idea of it. But once they get into the reality of it, that's a deal breaker for most. And I don't know if it's like that in your sport where people say, yeah, I'm going to, you know, but they really don't understand what it took for Kat Long to be as good as she is. They really don't get that.
Leo, you couldn't be more right. I mean, there are so many people that walk in and, you know, they just got done watching a Bruce Lee movie and they're so excited about coming in. I want to be a Bruce Lee.
Yeah.
But what they don't understand is that the first thing you have to do is learn stances and learn and do them correctly and practice them over and over and over and then learn proper striking and learn. And, you know, it's very much like they seem to forget what it was like to learn how to read.
Yeah.
First, you have to learn the alphabet. And then eventually you learn to put words together and learn how the certain letters sound. And, you know, in their mind at 20 years old, well, I've been reading, you know, since I was 5 years old.
Exactly.
But they don't remember what it was like to learn how to read or even learn how to walk, because some of them are quite too young to remember that. But
yeah.
Still, it's that whole concept. Learn how to use a fork and eat and feed yourself.
Yeah, you forget that, you know.
Yes, we do.
No,
we all do.
Yeah, it's a crack up.
You know, if you can look at it as, oh my God, here's an opportunity to learn something new and literally learn it from the very, very beginning.
You know, and when I tell people, you know, they say, because so many like you, they come, yeah, I want to be a competitor. And I'm saying, well, first of all, maybe you should understand something. And what this is, it goes to your point. There's a process here. And when I say a process, I mean that, to give you some perspective, if you think that you want to get to a national level, at least in bodybuilding, it takes about 10 years to get there, you know, to really get to the point where you have now, you're becoming a master of, you know, being able to produce a certain look. I mean, I would guess that maybe, how long does it take in your sport to become, let's just say now at your level, or a regional level versus a national versus a pro level. How many years is it actually going to take? And can you compute that into how many hours a day in the gym? When you put that in that kind of reality, the people run out of the gym.
They absolutely do run out of the gym. I mean, if they're, first off, you know, fighting is not for everybody. Of course, neither is bodybuilding. But in that respect, for a fighter's mentality, you have to understand that you're going to have hundreds of thousands and millions of punches thrown at you, kicks thrown at you, knees thrown at you, elbows thrown at you. And you have to learn to be calm under that pressure and be comfortable with that. And that's one of the hardest things for people to overcome, is the whole idea of punches and kicks being thrown at them and being able to stay calm under the pressure and then have an answer for that. It takes a lot longer than people, you know, there are a lot of guys out there who will just, you know, they'll play around and spar and they'll have fun and they think they're good enough to go have a fight. And maybe they are, maybe they're not, but usually they're not.
Yeah.
Like almost 9.9 times out of 10, they're not. But, you know, they think they've horsed around enough in the gym, you know, sparring with their buddies, and they think, oh, well, okay, that's what it is, but it's not.
Right.
It's not even close. And if you want to have the skill level, you have to be so well-rounded in your offense and your defense, in your timing, in your ability to make them miss, and in your ability to stay calm under pressure. There's so many attributes to become a fighter, not so much a good fighter, but to become a fighter, period. And then if you want to be a good fighter, then you have to, the key to that is to spar against as many different types of people with different skill levels as you possibly can. And not many get that opportunity because they become really good in their own gym,
right?
And they think they've mastered it. And then they go to somebody else's gym and they get their ass kicked.
Right.
And they go, "What the hell happened?
Yeah.
I was beating everybody in my small little pond. I was the big fish there. What the fuck?"
Yeah. Well, there's your answer. You were the small fish in the big pond, or the other way around. You know,
the big fish in a small pond. Exactly.
Yeah. And when you step outside of that, boy, it's an eye opener, isn't it?
It truly is. And that's why world champions don't train in just one place. They go to different places and they learn new things, and they have to evolve and they have to grow and they have to get outside of their comfort zone and make things uncomfortable. And then learn that, you know, this is okay. I'm not going to die.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. It may feel like it, but you're really not going to die most of the time.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. That's really funny. So is there, talking about these guys or these people that end up, you know, learning one style, would you say there's one style of martial arts that's better than the other, or what's your take on that? Before you answer that, I just wanted to get the answer to the other question. How many years does it take, would you say, just on average, to get to, let's just say, a pro level? How many years does it take to get there on the average?
It largely depends on the individual, but I will say this. It can take, if you're truly dedicated and you're the gym rat and you're the one who wants to really fight, it can take someone, you know, 3 to 4 years mm-hmm. of constant training and competing, you know, as often as they possibly can on an amateur level, you know, travel wherever they need to travel to compete. I mean, it can take, you know, 3 to 4 years. But they really need a ton and ton, absolute ton of fighting, because if you're just doing a few in your own city, in your own town, or your own state for that matter, you're not going to get there nearly as quickly as you could.
Yeah.
But it truly does depend on the individual. Some adapt quickly and learn quickly and have a love for competing and have a knack for it. And others don't. They have to work more.
Right.
They have to work much harder. They have to take more time in the gym and practice more.
Yeah.
It just depends. But to get to a world class level, you know, we're looking at 7-8 years, and that's, you know, starting young and competing a crap load.
Yeah, and you know, one of the things that made me sit up in my chair was that, you mean I have to take hundreds of thousands of punches and elbows to get there?
And knees and kicks.
And knees and kicks. So, ma'am, if you think, or sir, if you think you want to compete, think about that, what I just said. Just think about that for a moment. Don't answer me right now. Let it sink in. Tell me if you still want to do this, because I think it might change your sport. I don't know. I'm just saying. Okay, now, is there one style of martial arts that's better than the other? I know in my sport, it's like, okay, what's better? Heavy lifting to put on muscle or volume training? And it's just like, it's a combination of the two. So how does that work in martial arts? Is there one style that you would say is...
Well, let's talk about martial arts, because when you use the word martial, which is, you know, you go back to the god Mars, who is the god of war, there are martial arts in every single country in the world. So depending on what you want to accomplish from it, there is no one martial arts that is the best martial arts in the world. Absolutely not. There's no way you can claim that this is the best martial arts. It depends on what the person wants to achieve with that martial arts. So if they want to achieve inner health and flexibility, then Tai Chi is a great one. It's not for old people. Tai Chi is the kind of art that you can do fast and you can do slow, and it builds up an unbelievable amount of strength, both ligament strength and muscle strength. Or you could do, if you want to compete, then you can do, you know, arts like Sanshou, or you can do arts like, there are several hard style karate systems that allow you to compete in point fighting. It really does depend on the individual and what they want to accomplish.
Yeah. Interesting. I know it's kind of like, you know, when I hear somebody say, well, and when they're black and white in their answers, you know, usually that tells me that person really doesn't have enough experience under their belt to be able to talk about what you're saying. I mean, you've been around and you know that, you know, it's kind of like when somebody says, no, there's no doubt in my mind that the best way to put on muscle is strength. Well, okay. You're not seasoned enough to really make that answer. And I don't buy it anymore, you know, type thing.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Do you think that in the industry now that it's gotten more commercialized, based on what you've said, do you think that belts are given out too frequently?
Oh, boy. You know, if you listen to Dynamic Dojo Talk Radio, that's a radio show that my partner and I do every Sunday. Those are topics that do come up, and there's no good way to answer that.
I think you may did. So maybe I'm overstepping here, but you know, I would think that for those people that are out there that aren't really a purist to their sport and they're in the business, they might want to put profits over, you know, making that person a legitimate black belt. Did I overstep?
Well, let's look at it this way, Leo. I mean, you have to make a living. If you're going to teach martial arts and that is your sole source of income, then, you know, you need to obviously run a good business. But, you know, in the old days, literally in the old days, when you came into a school, you adopted that lifestyle and you became, you know, not only the student of that master, but you're also part of that family.
Yeah.
And you're not so concerned about, oh, I want my blue belt. Oh, I want my orange belt. Oh, I want my purple belt.
Yeah.
I want to know what I have to do in order to get my black belt. And no, the whole idea back then was just to train and adopt that lifestyle and become the best martial artist at that point you could be. And at some point, you know, there was no belt given. There was no ranks given. You know, you became a disciple of that master.
Right.
And you became very proficient because you had that was your lifestyle. Now, you look at Americans, and they want that instant gratification. They want to know that they've done something. They want to know that they are something. They want to know that they've accomplished this or that.
Right.
And they need that belting system in order for them to feel like they've accomplished something.
Interesting.
And there's nothing wrong with that necessarily, but it's a personal inner journey that you take when you decide to do martial arts,
yeah,
depending on the master that you have. Some masters, or, you know, I say masters or instructors, because not all instructors are masters. But I do say that if their mindset is, I want to give belt testing as often as possible because I'm charging $60, $70, $80 for it, or $100, and I'm going to promote people as often as possible because it's $50, $60, $80, $100 for belt testing.
Exactly.
And, you know, if that is their sole mindset, you know, I'm going to advance these people as fast as I can because, you know, I need the money.
Yeah.
Or I want to make sure that the money's coming in, or I make them go to this tournament where they have to buy a certain uniform in order to compete in this tournament, and they have to buy it from me so I get a profit from
right.
it. You know, we call those the McDojos.
What did you call them?
We call those the McDojos.
McDojos.
The McDojos. The ones who will forgo, you know, proper instruction just for the fact that, you know, they want these people to advance as quickly as possible so they can get their belts. Yeah. They'll sell you a belt, a black belt, for $1,000. I guarantee you within 3 years, you give me $1,000 or however much money it is, and you'll have your black belt.
Yeah.
Whether they can physically do it or not, they'll get their black belt. They'll get it.
Yeah.
Now, you know, those are the ones that drive me absolutely insane, the McDojos, the ones who truly don't care about the quality of instruction that they give or the quality of students that they put out.
Yeah.
Those drive me crazy.
And me too, because, you know, in the industry, you know, I see so many social media. I like social media, but, you know, like everything else, it has its downside. And some of the people that are out there, you know, professing all this personal training and the stuff that you should be doing, it is pretty gross. And I know why they're doing it, and it ties into what you're saying. And it drives me batshit crazy to the point where,
you know,
I've written about it in these exposing fake trainer book that I have. But that's another story. I wanted to ask you, did you ever incorporate weight training, cardio? I mean, you did some running, so you did that. But how about weight training and nutrition in your career? Did you ever do much of that, or did that change for you?
I did do weight training. I really wanted to go up in weight class because I was at bantamweight, and we realized after a few fights in bantamweight that, you know, the bulk of the women fighters were in featherweight, which is, you know, the bottom end of that, it would be 124 or 125 up to, I think, 128, give or take. It just depended on the organization. So, you know, I chose to work with a powerlifter, a female powerlifter, because I wanted that explosiveness. I wanted the lean muscle mass. I wanted to gain the muscle and not, you know, by eating way too much. I mean, I don't know if you remember our last interview where I talked about the fact that I was lucky to eat once a day.
Right.
And, you know, I don't know how I survived that, but I did for whatever reason.
Body becomes its function.
Training with a powerlifter.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
No. I'm just saying, but body becomes its function. That's what it was doing when you did that. It had to adapt.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. But training with that powerlifter, I put on... It took me months, but I gained about 4.5-5 pounds of really super lean muscle. But I was so much more explosive in my punching and sprinting and running and hills and stairs and kicking. And I was so much leaner, and I loved it. I absolutely loved it. I think that this powerlifter did actually put me on some nutritional supplements like protein shakes and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
I can't remember, but it was all part of the package that she worked with me on. And I think that was probably later in my career, but I was so much more confident in my striking ability and my kicking ability, and so much more confident in being able to hit somebody harder.
Yeah.
Because of the powerlifting. And I was so grateful. I don't remember who the woman was, and I don't even remember her name. It was so sad because she was a great trainer.
Yeah. And back in the 80s when I started, I was 82, but when I started actually training athletes, it was probably, you know, a few years after that, maybe 84, 85, something like that. But one of the things that was interesting, this had more to do with baseball, as I got into training baseball players. And it was they were so afraid of doing weight training back then because they thought that it would mess up their swing, you know. And of course, when I went to spring training with one of the guys, the pros there, this is when, do you remember Jose Canseco and Mark McGuire?
Yes.
Okay, the Bash Brothers. Well, those guys really turned baseball on its head with the you know, they brought weight training into the sport. So my question for you is, are people doing more weight training now in the sport, and are they addressing these different aspects that can actually improve their sport? Is that happening more now, would you say, compared to when you started?
Oh, it's so much more high tech, quote unquote, and advanced than it ever has been. I mean, not only do they do weight training, but they also do, you know, all kinds of other types of exercises, you know, flipping tires and hitting tires with a sledgehammer and so many more things that I could possibly describe at this point.
Yeah.
You know, box jumps and with plyo boxes and cones and running with, you know, a small parachute and speed training and you name it, they do it now because, they're finding that if you just do the old style of training where you only hit the bag, you jump rope, you hit the focus mitts, you do your push-ups and calisthenics, they're finding that obviously that type of training just doesn't cut it. It just doesn't cut it.
Right.
There's no way you can get in the shape and the condition and strengthen not only your muscles, but your tendons.
Right.
It's not going to work if you're just doing the old school, quote unquote, old school type of training.
Right.
So weightlifting is a huge part of it now, along with all kinds of other conditioning type training.
Yeah, that's good. Things keep evolving, and in a lot of sports, and just I don't know, it's more than a sport. It transcends. You can become very irrelevant if you're not willing to be open to adapt to something new. You know,
change.
Yeah, change. Exactly.
You have to adapt to change. You have to go with it. Otherwise, you will get left behind.
That's exactly right. Yeah. So tell me, what was your defining moment in this whole, all the years that you've been involved in your sport and what you're doing now? What's your most defining moment, would you say?
Gosh, I have several.
However, I believe it.
I'll talk about two of them because these two, really came at very important times in my life. I was a beginning pro fighter. I think it was 1989, maybe 1990. I think it was 89. And I went to London and I fought a girl whose name is escaping me at the moment. It's kind of funny. But when I got to London to fight, I mean, I was there 10 days before contractually because I needed to acclimate to the weather and the time change and all that stuff, food, whatever else. So I was in Manchester training. And then on the day of the fight, day before the fight, I went to London and I get there and they changed the rules. They, instead of international rules where you're allowed to kick to the legs, inside and out the legs, they decided to go to modified Muay Thai rules where you're allowed to clinch and knee. And because I was a beginning pro fighter, I really did not understand those rules. Not very well. I dabbled in it, but I wasn't really good at it or proficient at all. So I looked at him and I said, you know what? Here's my contract. And I pulled it out and I showed him. I said, here are the rules that you told me we were going to fight under. He goes, well, it doesn't matter because I'm the promoter and I changed the rules.
Ooh. Take that.
So take that. And, you know, he goes, you're welcome to go home and I'm not going to pay you.
Wow.
And I thought, fuck that shit.
Well,
I'm fighting.
You should have drop kicked him right there and said, okay, let's go.
I should have hit him. Yeah, no kidding. But I took the fight and she schooled me. She just gave me a schooling the whole freaking fight. And I got beat soundly. I didn't get hurt at all. But she just outclassed me and outfought me in under those rules. And when they announced her the winner by unanimous decision, I thought to myself, okay, fair enough. You know what? I accepted a fight under rules I'm not familiar with. And I learned something from this. You know, I learned several things. One is I need to learn Muay Thai. And two, you know, I need to learn to have somebody who's going to be my advocate if I'm in another country, you know, to make sure that this sort of thing doesn't happen.
Right.
Right. And the defining moment was after they announced her the winner by unanimous decision and everybody's taking pictures, blah, blah, blah. They're interviewing her and I'm gathering up my things and I'm stepping out of the ring. And as I'm walking down the big, huge aisle, my trainer/boyfriend starts screaming at me. I mean, he's humiliating me. And all of a sudden, we're talking 30 to 35,000 people in the audience. You could hear a freaking pin drop.
Wow.
Because he's screaming and yelling at me in such a way that it made everybody stop and listen. And I'm being humiliated. And I looked at him and I thought to myself, okay, if this is what it means to lose, I'm never going to lose again, ever.
He didn't know what he did for you at that point. And
no,
and what he did was just bullshit, total. But you took that and spun that in a way that obviously worked for you. Kudos to you.
Yeah.
You know?
It did. The second defining moment was years after I retired from kickboxing, I was boxing professionally. And I was up for a mini tournament in boxing. And in my bracket, I beat the fighters, and I got to the point where at the final, and, you know, of course, it's just a regular boxing match. You know, it's not like you have to fight several people in one night. But I flew to Louisiana with my trainer, and this is a totally different trainer, but I flew to Louisiana with my trainer, and, you know, again, I'm there 10 days before, and I'm training and running and eating and having a good time and enjoying the training and having, I'm just excited about the fight because, you know, this is a girl who's trained by Angela Dundee, and
Wow. She's
really good. And I thought, okay, I'm in the South. I'm in Louisiana. That's their hometown. And, you know, everybody loves Angela Dundee. So, of course, they're going to root for this fighter. And I'm thinking to myself, all right, this is it. It's on. This is going to be, you know, a moment of a true test to me to see how I can do.
Yeah.
And then I get sick. Really badly sick, and I've got a horrible cold, and I feel miserable. And I go to the State Athletic Commission, and I say to them, you know, I go putting on my best face, and I say, I've got a little stuffy nose. Can you tell me what I'm allowed to take over-the-counter medicines? And they gave me a list of things I could take over-the-counter, and I bought them all, and I took them all the day of the fight. So my whole body is buzzing, and that's the only term I can think of it. It's just, I've got so much, you know, over-the-counter medicine stuffed in my body.
Yeah, you're having side effects from all of them.
I didn't feel anything.
Yeah.
And my mind kind of checked out, and my body said, okay, I got this. So I went into basic autopilot, and I'm fighting this girl. And I really don't remember much of the fight at all. But what I do know is after the fight, when they announced her the winner by unanimous decision, I looked down at the ground and I thought to myself, okay, I'm tired of getting sick. I'm never going to get sick again, ever.
Was that the last time you were sick?
That's the last time I was sick.
Unbelievable. I just love your energy. Listen, Kathy, we're going to go ahead and wrap this up a little bit, but I want to say something to you. It's, you know, my mission way back when was to always, you know, search for the truth and share that with others. And I learned that along the way from other people like the Bulgarians who kept passing this information forward. And, you know, there's no better way to tap into other experiences and to get a different perspective. And that's the reason that I wanted to do this show with you, because number one, you're the real deal. I mean, when I met you, you know, we did our YouTube interview a while back. I mean, I was so impressed with you. And the proof of that is that you're still relevant as far as I'm concerned. And the way you talk, I can tell you're still relevant and you're a major presence in the industry. And I'll tell you what, I don't give a damn what happened in your career. That is, to me, the mark of a true champ. And that's one of the reasons why I wanted, you know, the audience to hear your take on this. It's really interesting to talk to you, and I'm hugely impressed about you. So thank you for coming on the show.
God bless you, Leo. Thank you so much.
And I hope the best for you. I hope everything works out for you in Seattle. And maybe another time we can do this again if you'd like to.
I'd love to.
Okay,
anytime.
Kat? Okay, Kat, I really appreciate that. You have a good day, okay?
I will. You too. Thank
okay.
you.
Bye-bye now.
Bye.